Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I very much hope that our resignation from office will perhaps persuade those people who don't support the direct views of the people who are organizing this strike. I hope that those people will recognize that we have done this to give them an opportunity to speak up and to be listened to.
The Ulster workers' strike succeeded. It brought down the Sunningdale executive. The Council of Ireland was binned.
The strikers wanted to get rid of the executive. They've now done that, apparently. Do you feel that this is a victory on their behalf?
I suppose they could count it as that. It's tragic that the cost in crippling Northern Ireland has been so great.
Power sharing was shelved for a generation.
Mr. Paisley, Mr. Craig and Mr. West, they have said that they would not be prepared to sit with representatives of the Catholic community.
Loyalism stood triumphant.
There is no question of any executive being formed under that act. That act is dead.
It seemed like total victory. But was it?
Brian Faulkner said that I just looked at people who had been willfully misled by hand-me-down Carsons, who were going to realise that there was no victory won today.
What happened next?
The Irish government began to panic because it thought the British government might actually create the circumstances in which it did withdraw.
What was the lasting impact of the Ulster workers' strike?
But it's a question that unionism has needed to answer since then. You know, you never seem to be clear what it is you want.
In his final speech in the executive, Brian Faulkner said that after 5 months of being able to work together, Catholic and Protestant, I hope that one thing can remain, that we don't attack each other on a sectarian basis ever again. That was a forlorn hope.
The police were never in any doubt that this was an IRA bombing.
The freedom fighters say they carried out this shooting.
Dragged the men from the car, beat them up and later shot them.
Some panic as the gunman opened fire on mourners and threw grenades at them.
From Omagh, 28 people were murdered here.
It took another 25 years to return to a power-sharing situation.
After a generation of bloodshed and decades of division and acrimony, George Mitchell ushers in what the whole island hopes will be a new era of peace.
To look at the aftermath of the Ulster workers' strike, I'm joined by Professor Michael Kerr, journalist Don Anderson, commentator Alex Kane, and former top civil servant Robert Ramsay. Harold Wilson, the British Prime Minister, seemed to lose all interest in Northern Ireland in the wake of the strike. He wanted out.
The £300 million a year now going into Northern Ireland. Yet people who benefit from all this now viciously defy Westminster. People who spend their lives sponging on Westminster and British democracy and then systematically assault democratic methods. Who do these people think they are?
Here's Professor Michael Kerr.
Wilson began to pursue a different policy, looking at creating the circumstances in which the British could reduce its rule and withdraw. I mean, I suppose the proof in that is the Irish government's reaction. The Irish government began to panic because it thought the British government might actually create the circumstances in which it did withdraw. You know, the Irish government asked the Irish army, you know, how would it respond if the British government did and conflict broke out north of the border? And the Irish response was that it had no capacity whatsoever to cope with such a conflict. There was 13,000 troops, and they said they could possibly, you know, move north of the border and hold Newry for about 24 hours whilst Catholics were evacuated from Belfast. But it would be better if they went by sea from Belfast to Dundalk or Dublin. The messages the Irish government were saying was, you know, don't even think about it. You know, the British must maintain their statutory commitment to Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland had not factored on the British government's radar in 50 years. Irish politics, you know, was something that Westminster had stopped dealing with whenever Ireland was partitioned. And, you know, the rude awakening of the Troubles and the imposition of Northern Ireland politics at Westminster was very unwelcome. And British policy at that time was to reverse that.
So, Harold Wilson had no attachment to the union with Northern Ireland. After the strike, he felt it was time to push Northern Ireland further away. Here's author Don Anderson.
His idea was to give it dominion status, which would in fact take it out of the United Kingdom. And that plan was put in place and wasn't actually revealed until the 30-year rule came in. And unionism ought to actually have a long look at that, because it's an episode that's been forgotten, but it shouldn't be forgotten. If ever there was a red light for unionism, it's that.
But did unionism take into account the danger of alienating the UK government, of pushing them too far?
No. It wasn't then part and parcel of unionist thinking, and in my view, it still isn't. And it is entirely possible that the union could be broken on the other side rather than this side. In fact, that's what Carson himself believed, if unionism didn't play its cards correctly. Because what you had here was a loyalist revolt against British policy. The Conservatives and the Labour Party were unanimous that they were on the right course with the establishment of power sharing and Council of Ireland and so on. And this they considered to be a revolt against Britain. And it was so-called loyalists doing this. They found that very, very hard to understand.
It's being suggested that the British government, in the light of recent events, may be going for an agonising reappraisal of the whole relationship with Northern Ireland. Is this really on?
The British government, we're dealing with the position as it's been revealed since the earlier part of this week. But it is the short-term situation that we're dealing with at the moment.
So what lessons did the political establishment in London take from the strike? Michael Kerr says the idea of power sharing had taken hold anyway.
I think the lesson that William Whitelaw certainly learnt, Heath certainly learnt, the Conservative government learnt over the course of the 1970s, was that was the right policy. You know, Sunningdale fell and was defeated. The Ulster Workers' Strike destroyed the Northern Ireland Executive. But that didn't change their opinion one iota that this was the correct policy for Northern Ireland, and the only way that a broader settlement between the two governments that brought peace to Northern Ireland was going to come about was going to take place through some form of government like this, on this model. But what happened after that was the hunger strikes. So the policy was delayed then until the 1990s, but the British government kept coming back to it. And in fact, Merlin Rees, after Wilson had gone and he'd retired through illness under James Callaghan's government, attempted to coax the Northern Ireland parties to agree to a voluntary coalition between Vanguard, Paisley's DUP and the SDLP through a constitutional convention in 1976. And they were tempted, because Paisley was tempted by high office. But at that time, having destroyed the idea and destroyed Sunningdale so unequivocally, he didn't know how he would be able to square the circle of going into government with Catholics and maintaining his own Free Presbyterian Church and maintaining the loyalist support base that he'd rallied on the slogan of Dublin is just a Sunningdale away in destroying Faulkner's executive and his partnership with the SDLP.
I told him that was a dead duck, and if that's all the British government can come up with at this time, then they're on a non-starter. For they've run this horse before and it has fallen at the first hurdle, and they'll have to better shoot it and give it a decent burial.
The UK had never seen the likes of the Ulster worker strike. How did this act of rebellion affect London's perception of unionism in particular? Here's Alex Keane.
I think it changed dramatically how we were seen, because there was this sense, I mean, Harold Wilson's speech, which was a, you know, completely cack-handed approach to the whole thing, but he did make one point. He said, who do these people think they are? But it's a question that unionism has needed to answer since then, you know, who do you think you are? And this thing about, you know, you've just brought down a government that was underpinned by the sovereign parliament of the United Kingdom, a government that actually feeds into your exchequer vast sums of money, not simply on the security issue, but simply on societal and wider issues. We're helping to fund you because you, and we don't mind that. But you keep telling us you don't like this, you keep telling us you're against this, you keep telling us you want something different. But when we go to you and we ask you, you never seem to be clear what it is you want.
Unionism had rejected power sharing and the Council of Ireland. But what was the plan for what would come next? What did unionists want?
Unionism didn't understand what power sharing was. Unionism didn't understand that this was a new way. Northern Ireland was staying in the United Kingdom. Nobody was talking about, you know, moving Northern Ireland at that point. There was no talk of a serious border poll or anything like that about removing Northern Ireland from the United Kingdom. But there was just this sense that somehow they had been deprived of something and they're going to be deprived of something more. And when you look at it now, it's almost impossible to find anything, any document which says, here's the strike, this is what we're going to do, we're going to bring this down, and when this comes down, we're going immediately to the Secretary of State, immediately to the government, and say, this is our alternative, this is what we can live with. There was no evidence of that, nothing. So I think it was just, it's almost like a mad-eyed, wild-eyed reaction to something that was frightening them, and maybe that's what it is. Maybe it was just this fear. Reality is, I can't even remember the last time unionism stopped anything, because while they would argue, some people listening to this and old enough will say, oh, well, it stopped Sunningdale. It didn't stop power sharing. It didn't stop closer relations with Ireland. It didn't stop unionism being, as they would put it, serially betrayed by one government after another. There was no victory. There was no victory at Sunningdale.
Sunningdale was gone. But could it ever have worked? Michael Kerr.
It certainly might have worked, and it might also have collapsed and been put back together. It might have been suspended, or it might have been renegotiated, but that's not what happened. But there was a number of significant reasons why it didn't work. It wasn't the concept that was wrong. We know that because it has worked at different points for long periods of time over the last 25 years. But the context was problematic. Well, you know, the balance between the different parties, the strengths and weaknesses of the two governments, they were all problematic.
Robert Ramsey agrees.
I think if unionism had had more sense about their longer term own interests, and if nationalism, particularly the SDLP, had been more realistic about how they should present the settlement to their followers, I think our tragedy is that both sides rather fluffed the opportunity that history had presented them with.
Alex Keane also thinks that Sunningdale was an opportunity, but that it was lost when Brian Faulkner resigned the leadership of the UUP.
I voted for power sharing. As an 18-year-old who knew that things were changing, having talked to my dad and other people I knew, I had no difficulty with power sharing, because I thought, if you want people to be happy, then make them feel they belong. They may want a long-term ambition, that's fine. But for the immediate here and now, You know, make life, make them feel as though this is part of their country, that we share the same things, health, school, whatever it is. Constitutionally, we may differ, so be it, but the rest of it we can get on with. So I think if Faulkner had stayed in, I think if some other key people had fought that battle, and there were other key people, including senior officers in the Unionist Party, who resigned from the party at that time, very senior figures in the party, who would have all been passionate, I think, about power sharing. But we lost that core, that hard core of passionate power sharing unionists. So yes, personally, I believe power sharing could have worked and should have worked. Had Faulkner stayed at the core of this and kept control of the Ulster Unionist Party, because Trimble is right, if he had resigned and lost control of the Ulster Unionist Party, there wouldn't be an assembly now, because no one would have had the courage. The reason the DUP were able to make a deal with Sinn Féin is that Trimble kept the assembly alive from 1998 right the way through to 2003 until the DUP took over. He left it for them to pick up and rebuild it. Had he gone, the whole thing would have gone.
Despite that, Alex argues that perhaps unionism in general just wasn't ready for power sharing.
I think for unionism, Seamus Mallon's line, you know, that the Good Friday Agreement was Sunday deal for slow learners, I don't think that's true. I think the problem with unionism back in that period was that they hadn't yet recovered from the removal of Stormont from the Northern Ireland Parliament, something that had for 50 years. They'd controlled, unionism had controlled Northern Ireland. Every aspect of Northern Ireland was controlled by unionism. Go where you wanted in Northern Ireland. If it had to do with the government, the unionist mandate ran. If they wanted something to happen, it happened. If they didn't, it was stopped. That had gone overnight. That had gone. You know, but suddenly they're going, that your parliament's gone, your prime minister is gone, your cabinet is gone, your power, your authority, the right to give bubbles, the right to control, all of that has gone. And suddenly, 18 months down the line, they're told there's now going to be power sharing. They weren't ready, by no extension or of imagination or reality, were they ready for this. And a Council of Ireland thrown into that, that there's going to be this body with people from Dublin having an interference in there, having already been told by their own government, you've lost Stormont, now been told, oh, well, you have to have this as well. They weren't ready. So all this stuff about there was some grand plan, some great strategy for undoing, unplucking the whole Sunningdale process and replacing it with something that they'd carefully worked out, that they were ready to do the government after with and say, well, we'll accept this, we'll do that. I think that in reality is nonsense. I think just across unionism and loyalism, there was this sense that we've had Parliament removed from us, we're not going to have this forced upon us. It was about bringing the structure down. Nothing else mattered.
But ultimately, was it the politics or the protests which defeated Stormont?
The politics defeated Faulkner in the sense that he was a very isolated figure at the Sunningdale negotiation. He had no Willie Whitelaw was not there backing him up. And at Sunningdale, Faulkner was negotiating with Heath, against Fitzgerald, against Hume, and he did not have the likes of Paisley, John Taylor, Bill Craig backing him up. He didn't have a big, strong team. And he focused on the issues where he thought he needed wins, on recognition, on Articles 2 and 3, on security, and he failed to get any of them.
But had that section of political unionism, which believed that power sharing was necessary, done enough to prepare their community for it? Don Anderson argues no.
Part of the reason why it wasn't accepted is that unionism has been very bad in preparing its own electorate for compromise. Compromise remains a dirty word inside unionism. I mean, if you look at the orange banners, every third banner has no surrender. Maybe every banner has no surrender on it. Surrender and compromise are interchangeable words for many on that side of the political divide. And unionism has made, frankly, a hash of preparing its own side. Now, you contrast that with Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness having to prepare the Republicans for stopping the war without actually, if you like, driving the British out. They, frankly, did a superb job of going round the country, talking here, talking there, and getting the IRA to deliver up its weapons or put them beyond use. And that's something which is almost alien, in my view, to the Protestant side of the House They don't know how to do it.
So what did unionists actually want?
I think it's a fair point to make that the majority in their hearts would have wanted Stormont back with a majority of unionists, unionist majority again. Faulkner had already before, you know, with his back to 71, before it was done away with, Faulkner talked about setting up committees which would have included the official opposition, the SDLP and so on at that time. So there was within unionism an understanding that things had to change, that things were changing. Even then, even when the Sunningdale Assembly came down, there was no sense of, right, we still want devolution. We still want this. We can still accept that, you know, the Council of Ireland's gone. It had been killed at that moment. You know, when it came down the 28th of May and suddenly came, the Council of Ireland went down with it because it had never been formally ratified anyway. So it had gone. What you do in a case like that, you immediately say that the Bill Craig, Ian Paisley, Harry West, you know, various other people go to the government, seek a meeting with, was it Merlin Rees at that point, I think, with Secretary of State and with Wilson to try and unpick some of the damage with his Spunger speech and say, look, this is it. You did this. We didn't want this. We are still a majority. We proved we were the majority at 51%. We have a mandate to speak for a majority of people in Northern Ireland and a majority of unionism. Can we now talk about this? But they didn't do that. There was no sense of that being done. That is probably the most significant political, economic, societal strike we've seen in British history for over a century. You know, basically a government was brought down, you know. That's an extraordinary thing. It was clear. It was clear within a matter of months, and particularly when the convention election in 75, clear that unionism really didn't have a clue what it was asking the government to provide it with, because it hadn't thought it through. And in all of that, of course, you had all these varieties of orangism, loyalism, unionism, and loyalist paramilitaries, and those linked to older loyalist paramilitaries. And within a while, they were all fighting with each other because they hadn't agreed. If you're going to bring something down, if you're going to have a revolution, and it's usually a good idea to be quite clear what you want the end goal, not to go, oh, well, we got rid of that. Well, what do we do now?
In September 1974, Brian Faulkner broke with the UUP and formed the Unionist Party of Northern Ireland.
We are different from the Paisley Unionists, the people that are ready to discuss various forms of association with the United Kingdom. We say no to that. We remain an integral part of the United Kingdom. And the second basic and fundamental part of our policy is partnership in a regional government in Northern Ireland. And that's why we entitle our manifesto, The Union and Partnership. We believe that it is essential that there should be a regional government in Northern Ireland. And we believe that for that regional government to be stable, it must be able to draw support from right across the community. And the only way it can draw support from across the community is by having in it representatives of basically the two outlooks in Northern Ireland.
But that party wasn't successful. In 1976, he left active politics. He was elevated to the Lords in 1977. But lost his life in a riding accident soon after. Michael Kerr reflects on how Brian Faulkner's career ended with the overthrow of Sunningdale.
We should remember where Faulkner was coming from. Whenever he began talking to the SDLP in 1973 through Whitelaw, he was the unpopular, hardline unionist prime minister that had, you know, brought in an internment and taken a very, very tough line on any idea of compromising really with the nationalist community, and had sought to end the troubles through draconian security measures. You know, Hume would have rather had a different unionist leader, so would Oliver Napier of the Alliance Party. But by the time they had worked together for 5 months, their view of Faulkner had changed completely. There was a unionist leader that had bought into fully the idea of cross-community government, of working together for the good of all, and, you know, had really won over their trust. And they wouldn't have trusted him at all before 1974. You know, he invested all his political capital in Sunningdale, but, you know, he wasn't able to by that stage invest the political capital of the majority community or its representatives in Sunningdale, because he'd lost that position in government. It had ebbed away.
What price did Brian Faulkner pay for his failure? Had he in fact become a version of his old rival, Captain Terence O'Neill? Here's his former private secretary and confidant, Robert Ramsay.
Yes, I think not that he expressed it in very personal terms, but I think he had been disappointed within his own party that the leadership of the party had gone for O'Neill rather than himself. I mean, he agreed with a great deal that O'Neill was trying to do, but he didn't think that O'Neill was the man to do it. I mean, O'Neill had all the right instincts, but he didn't really come across as someone with whom the unionist community could easily identify. So there was a personal rivalry between them within the party context. But he also thought, I mean, his disappointment in a way, particularly in the power-sharing executive days, was that he was disappointed with London, particularly with Merlin Rees, whose handling of the workers' strike was pretty disastrous and led to a general feeling that the setup couldn't survive. So he thought there was a great weakness in London of indecision and, to a certain extent, disinterest. And I think when you look back and see how that strike was handled, for example, and compare it to later on in another civil service job, I was principal private secretary to Roy Mason when he was Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. And of course, there towards the end of his time, there was a similar attempt led by Ian Paisley to have a rerun of the workers' strike. And at that time, the decisive action taken by Mason showed that that sort of disturbance for political reasons could be handled. And the Paisley strike completely failed.
Well, the stoppage is halted in the meantime. And it's over to Mr. Mason. And the eyes of Ulster will be on Mr. Mason and what Mr. Mason's going to do. And if Mr. Mason is going to do nothing, then we, of course, will reconsider our position. And we will be prepared to call another strike.
And that was largely due to the way that London dealt with that. If you look back and make the comparison with Merlin Rees and the workers' strike, which brought down the power-sharing executive, that was a key element of the difference in the two situations.
Partnership is the word that we have used in our election manifesto. Partnership is the word that we will continue to use, not power-sharing. Partnership between the different traditions in this part of Ireland, and partnership between North and South, building a new North and a new Ireland.
Brian Faulkner's partner on the nationalist side was the SDLP.
Back then, the SDLP was considered as green and as Republican as Sinn Féin is now. Unionists saw the SDLP as the enemy because they thought these were people who were either closet Republicans or closet IRA or had history in the IRA or something like that. The SDLP, for a lot of unionists and loyalists, were seen as the enemy.
Robert Ramsay believes that the SDLP's hard line contributed to Faulkner's woes, but that John Hume later moved away from his Sunningdale position.
I think if you look at John Hume, like many politicians in a leading position over the years, he changed a great deal from saying, you know, right now is the moment for, a big step towards Irish unity. But he came then to develop the idea of consent. And of course, he had the vision then after the Good Friday Agreement to see that within Europe, that the differences between North and South, as experienced by the population at large, that the earlier historical differences were gradually being eroded. And he could see that as a European dimension to it. And that it's a pity that he hadn't seen that at an earlier stage. But there were differences within the SDLP, and that was very clear, that people who eventually broke away from the SDLP, like Jerry Fitt and Paddy Devlin, who were more sort of socialists rather than nationalists. I mean, they had a background in nationalism, but that was on the back burner as far as they were concerned. And there was a lot of friction on that side between those who were very much urban socialists as against the more rural, traditional nationalists, which eventually split the SDLP.
So, with Sunningdale gone and the strikers victorious, where did that leave unionism? Alex Kane.
In his biography, Memoirs of a Statesman, Brian Faulkner said that when he resigned, he had to drive down from the main hill of Stormont past Carson's statue and the people around it shouting and jeering at him. And he just writes something along the lines, again, I'm paraphrasing slightly, something along the lines, I just looked at people who had been willfully misled by hand-me-down Carsons, who were going to realise that there was no victory won today. My going down this hill is not a victory for anyone. What the strike did, it was damaged. What unionism thought of itself, I think, was seriously damaged by the 1974 strike, because people didn't understand. The very people we needed were in America, in Dublin, in London, the national media, politicians at Westminster, the political establishment, the media establishment. I think there was just this sense, what is unionism? And we're left in a situation where 50 years later, we're still asking that same question. Before unionism moves on, it needs to understand what it is and where it wants to be.
This special series of The Bell Tale was written and co-produced by myself, Kieran Dunbar. Graham Davidson was the sound designer and co-producer, with Olivia Peden as assistant producer. The clips you heard were from AP, the BBC, Channel 4 and RTE.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.